From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. This is McBride and Brennan with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk. TNT. TNT Radio.
Hello. Welcome to McBride and Brennan. This is David McBride. And Robert Brennan is out there somewhere, and I'm particularly happy. We've got a fantastic guest in today. If you told me that 5 years ago I'd be on radio talking to this man, I wouldn't have believed you. It's someone, I'll give you a little bit of a clue about it this week, someone who the Defence Force hates almost as much as me, maybe even more. He is hated by the Defence Force because he did 6 or 7 tours, and he expresses opinions on things like maybe the Chief of the Defence Force should have a look at his own service medals before he asks people to hand back their service medal. Maybe they have a case to answer in an international criminal court. He asks questions like that, and therefore he thinks that maybe we give people interpreters, and if we get them to work for us in Afghanistan and put their lives on the line, we should do everything we can to bring them back to Australia after we leave. All sorts of very, very controversial opinions, which I think most of you agree are pretty damn good opinions. He is a fellow officer, an officer I'm very proud to say I serve next to in Afghanistan, and his name is Major Stuart McCarthy. Hello, Stuart.
Morning, Dave. Happy Sunday. Morning, Robert, sitting across from me in the studio here.
Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, and I'm so happy to have you here in the studio. And you've been in the news this week. In fact, you've actually had an article in the Daily Telegraph today, I think, which made my heart sing reading it. You argue so cogently and beautifully written, and what you say is makes perfect sense to me, because you, like me, have been sort of, I guess, fighting is the best word, but we would say doing our job, standing up, being the best officers we can, looking after both our troops and actually the mission for Australia as best we can. And you argue that while, you know, it is a fairly contentious question about people who are the mid-ranking officers above the special forces on the ground, whether they have to give back their distinguished service medals, you say this is probably a clever distraction to take the public's sort of focus away from the fact that it's the leadership of the Australian Defence Force, the very top, people like the Governor-General, David Hurley, and people like the present Chief of the Defence Force, Angus Campbell, who really have the big questions to answer. Why is recruitment so low? Why is all the equipment such a schmozzle? We've wasted billions. And the whole point of the military is that those at the top, even if they might be relatively blameless, but people at the top have to take responsibility. Anyway, maybe you can tell us about your article today and what's been going on this week.
Yeah, well this is something that you and I definitely have in common, David, is that as people who served in the, I guess, the middle ranks of the Defence Force during a interesting historical period, I guess we could describe it as that, is that we're always questioning the leadership at the highest levels, you know, right at the, in this case, at the level of the Chief of the Defence Force. Now, there's a whole lot of background on this that some of your listeners might not be fully across, and I guess we'll probably spend some time this morning digging into that. But very broadly, a couple of years ago, there was an inquiry report known as the Brereton Inquiry Report, published in Australia after a lengthy administrative inquiry, that which ostensibly was conducted to follow up so-called rumours of various war crimes that may have been committed by Australian Special Forces troops, mainly during the period 2006 to 2013 in Afghanistan. It's a very lengthy inquiry, and while the inquiry was underway, there was all sorts of leaks were being made, obviously out of the Department of Defence and possibly ministerial officers that really targeted the junior and mid-ranking soldiers who were involved in these very serious alleged crimes. And to people like you and I, it seemed like another case of, well, this there's been these rumours and allegations and media stories of that just won't go away for over a period of years. And it just seemed to yourself and myself and other people who with a similar background that it was largely a case of, well, you know, there's so much heat here that something needs to be done, and we need to have a big inquiry, and we need to throw some people under the bus. We need to scapegoat the most junior people we possibly can. So it's a bit of a broad brush background. Now, that report was published a couple of years ago, and as I've noted in the article I wrote this morning, there's certainly a lot of issues in the Brereton Inquiry report that the government does need to address. There can be no denying that. But there's been a change in government recently, and some of the efforts that were made by the Chief of the Defence Force under the previous government to go after the sort of seniorish or middle-ranking commanders in Australian Special Forces to follow up those recommendations were knocked back by the previous government. What's happened in this past sort of week or 10 days is, as was reported by the Telegraph and some of the other media, what the Chief of the Defence Force has done is that he apparently has written to some of the Special Forces commanders who were serving at, you know, from captain to around colonel level back during that period, who had received distinguished service awards for their service in Afghanistan, and demanded that they respond to him justifying why they should retain those awards, and questioned whether their service was in fact distinguished. Now, one of the ironies, and a number of us have pointed out General Campbell's pretty obvious hypocrisy here, is that he himself was awarded a Distinguished Service Cross for his service as the Australian National Commander, the Major General in command, or in national command of the entire contingent of Australian troops in Afghanistan and the Middle East in 2011. Now, there's a lot of elements to this, but a number of us have taken issue with that. And one of the points that I made out, particularly in the very short piece I wrote this morning, was that there is still very much a question to be answered of the most senior level of the leadership, including General Campbell. And we're not talking about a question of moral accountability or you know, these sort of vague terms with no legal or criminal weight behind them. What we're talking about here is a question of responsibility under the Rome Statute, which is the, you know, these are the international laws governing, you know, the International Criminal Court, you know, war crimes. Now, one of the very serious shortcomings of the Brereton Inquiry report was that it exempted the senior leadership, the most senior levels of the Australian military leadership from this concept of command responsibility, because the Justice Brereton found that that the most senior levels of the Australian military leadership didn't have, quote, sufficient command and control of the Australian Special Forces involved in these alleged crimes, which you and I know is not quite true, and that's another one of the issues that that I've taken issue with. And so the question that we have now, given General Campbell's response and given that the new Australian government is not or seems not to be pursuing that high level accountability, there's a question now as to whether or not the International Criminal Court themselves may exercise their own discretion to look specifically into that question of command responsibility at the highest levels in the Australian Defence Force.
Yeah, I must admit, I've always thought that. You and I, being specialists in the area and knowing a lot about it, I suspected, and we also have a model that the same thing happened in the UK. They made a lot of fuss about war crimes publicly, etc., and then they did nothing. And that is, for you and I, that's quite suspicious. It looks like they were trying to get the International Criminal Court off the back. Unlike the US, of course, we're a signature. We're a founding member of the International Criminal Court. And the International Criminal Court, when they come looking at a country, they don't look at the corporals and the privates. They look at the leadership. And that would scare Australia. Always trying to get on the Security Council. We're always trying to punch above our weight. And if we got investigated over Afghanistan, it would be big shaming for us. But, of course, it looks like, well, it's possible, one interpretation of the Brereton Report was it was simply to get the International Criminal Court off our case. And this latest missive from General Campbell could be, again, another smokescreen to say, oh, look, we're doing something, when actually they're not doing something, and they're not doing something against the people that really matter. I mean, again, it's counterintuitive. People who were not in the Defence Force wouldn't know, but some of the key tangential things that came out in the Ben Robert Smith defamation case were very interesting. One of them was the fact that Andrew Hastie, who was an SAS commander, a captain, he said he had his doubts about Ben Robert Smith and made complaints about Ben Robert Smith in 2012, 2013. And he complained to the RSM of the SAS regiment. Now, I think it's actually more likely that people like General Hurley had that information than the middle-ranking officers. The middle-ranking officers, the colonels, wouldn't necessarily know that. But something like that, if the SAS RSM got that information, I think you and I would both agree that he would have passed it on and it would have gone all the way to the top. Now, that doesn't mean Ben Robert Smith was guilty of anything, but it should have been investigated, and they didn't investigate it. And I think rather than point the fingers at the colonels who didn't necessarily know that stuff, they really should be looking at General Hurley, to say, if you either knew and you didn't do anything about it, in which case you're liable, or you're incompetent, that you really didn't have your finger on the pulse, that the senior RSMs knew about this and you, for some strange reason, didn't even hear the rumours, you know.
Well, here's another way, Dave, of looking at this broader situation. You know, as the Brereton Inquiry or components of the proceedings of the Brereton Inquiry were leaked to the media and reported in the media, there was this narrative emerged from both the military leadership in Australia and also the political leadership. And this narrative was, you know, we didn't know anything, we hadn't heard any of these allegations, they were only rumours, and the rumours came out of this, you know, culture review into special forces and so on and so forth. And even at the time, this narrative, for people who have an understanding of what was happening in Afghanistan, was laughable. One of the things that I did a few months ago, I went back and I looked at the Brereton Inquiry report, which is heavily redacted, unfortunately. Unfortunately, in the sense that it makes it, unless you have a good knowledge of what was happening in Afghanistan and when, you've got to, you need this sort of thing spelt out for you. It is quite legitimate that some of it is still redacted. But what I did was I looked at every serious incident, and we're talking about the incidents where there are alleged murders and so on. And I compared those to the public media reporting in the days and weeks that followed each incident. Now, some of these incidents happened around about the time that you and I served there. And what I discovered was that at least several of the incidents during that period, 2011 to 2013, when around the time you and I had served there, were front page news in Australia, internationally, in Afghanistan. And at least one of them, there was a very public dispute between the then Minister for Defence, the Australian Minister for Defence, Stephen Smith, and the then President of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai. And what the dispute was over was whether that particular mission, because even at the time there was no dispute that I think two civilians were killed in this particular raid, okay? What the dispute was over was apparently there had been an agreement between the two national governments, so the Australian government and the government of Afghanistan, that because the overall international mission was starting to wind down, that any Australian Special Forces missions or raids would need to be approved by the provincial governor. And there was a dispute as to whether the provincial governor had approved this particular mission. There was no argument about whether civilians had been killed in this raid. It was just about the details of who'd approved it and so on and so forth. And that was just one example. So this whole, Sergeant Schultz defence, we didn't know, we can't be held accountable, this was all kept secret from us by these corporals, planting weapons on dead bodies and so on. It is just so far-fetched and so ridiculous and so indefensible that if and when, a body like the International Criminal Court did, intervene and conduct their own investigation, it would, some of the things that would emerge from that would just be, potentially catastrophic for Australia's, certainly our military reputation and potentially our political one.
And now we're on up to a catastrophic cliffhanger. We'll just go to a quick ad break. This is TNT.
TNT Radio's Dirk Pohlman.
As an expert in international law, what's your position on Julian Assange's case?
I am a great admirer of Julian Assange, as I am an admirer of Edward Snowden and of other whistleblowers. Since my time as a UN staff member, and I was for decades a senior lawyer with the United Nations and the High Commissioner for Human Rights here in Geneva, I have been pleading for the drafting and adoption of a charter of rights of whistleblowers, because I think that whistleblowers are eminent human rights defenders. We need them desperately because our governments lie to us. Our governments commit war crimes and crimes against humanity in our names. And we don't know about it because secrecy is the key.
The Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio. A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. You're listening to McBride and Brennan with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Looks like it's just you and me, Stuart, for a little while.
Canberra's dropped off the radar.
Well, David comes back, I mean, I'm picking up on a few things and just kind of thinking meta. You know, the International Criminal Court, you were making a comment just as like an observation, like it's sunny outside, that Australia's a signatory, but the US isn't, which is incredibly troubling. It puts them outside of International Criminal Court law. But then on the other hand, it's pretty honest because they are the hegemon and they are above the law. I mean, even in wars they lose, they have the international community at their, as vassal states and da-da-da-da-da, and what's going to happen to them? So they might as well just say, look, we're above the law, we're outside of this, forget about it.
Yeah, it's a good point and it's an interesting question. And it's funny that you mentioned the term vassal state. And I guess the response that I would make is someone who served in the military for one of the vassal states, is that, you know, here we are a decade mm-hmm. after or longer after a series of very serious allegations, you know, have been aired. There's been a high level, what has been, you know, misportrayed as some kind of pseudo, you know, war crimes tribunal in Australia, which exonerated, you know, explicitly our most senior leaders. So there's this hanging question as to when, if, how, you know, the International Criminal Court could potentially come in and conduct some sort of investigation into that level. Mm. They haven't yet. But the point I would make is that our own government has not, as a matter of policy, even the Minister for Defence, when he was asked about this in Parliament the week just gone past, he essentially reiterated the fact that our own government won't be conducting investigations at that level. So the question I would have is, okay, well, look, as you pointed out, or David pointed out, we were one of the founding signatories to this statute. And I guess if you put this a broader question to politicians across the board in Australia about, why or whether or not Australia should have been a signatory, they say, oh, look, it's very important for our international reputation. We want to be in the lead of these issues. You know, we espouse the, quote, rules-based international order, unquote, and so on and so forth. But the question is, hang on a minute, what action has your government or the Australian government taken against, you know, this hanging question of command responsibility for alleged war crimes at that level? Mm-hmm. There's a certain element of hypocrisy there, even at that political level.
Mm. Yes, and you were saying about how there's the suggestion that, well, they didn't have enough, the higher command didn't actually have enough command to have accountability, but they have enough command in order to themselves receive a medal, which doesn't add up.
Yes, that exactly. That's a point that I've made and many other people have made as well. But it's worth digging into that side of the story a little deeper for your listeners as well. The mid-ranking commanders that General Campbell seems to have gone after are at that, the sort of captain to colonel level. So we're talking about individuals who were troop commanders, so in charge of, you know, 30-odd soldiers up to commanding officers, so in charge of what the Australians called the Special Operations Task Group. So, you know, lieutenant colonel in charge of, you know, several hundred individuals. So that's the level that they've gone after. Now, the odd arrangement, command and control arrangements that the Australian military came up with was to have an organisation that was known as Headquarters Joint Task Force 633, which was the Australian National Command element for all of the troops, the Australian troops that were stationed not only in Afghanistan but in the broader region, for a good couple of decades. Now, General Campbell was one of the commanders who served as Commander Joint Task Force 633 as the Australian National Commander. But it's one of these arrangements where it's a convenient sort of out. So when things are working well and there's, you know, photo opportunities of Australian troops doing these wonderful things, training the local Afghan forces and building schools and hospitals, and there's ministers want to come and visit and do, you know, happy smiley news reports. Well, hey, look, this is us. I'm here being the national commander. But when it goes bad, and this is a classic situation, there's this, oh no, we didn't have a sufficient degree of command and control. And that was the finding that was made in the Brereton inquiry. Mm-hmm. But again, people like myself and David, because we already have, you know, had served there and had an understanding of the realities, it's simply not true at all. It is true that the Australian Special Force contingent was under the under what's called operational control of the International Security Assistance Force during that period. However, there was absolutely and certainly there were numerous occasions where the Australian National Commander, and we're talking about the individual who was serving in the role that General Campbell did as Commander JTF 633, and this is now public information. There's a very, very good book. If we have time, I can touch upon this later on, published quite recently. One of General Campbell's predecessors in this role has said, you know, quite openly in this book, yeah, there were times where as the Australian National Commander, as Commander JTF 633, I was asked to add mid-ranking or senior Taliban targets to what was called the JPL or the target list, and specifically to approve SOTG missions that were then conducted against those targets, and even went to the extent of saying, look, you know, on occasion I would even listen to the radio, the tactical radio communications as these missions unfolded on the ground in Afghanistan. So it's a complete myth that the commander's Joint Task Force 633 had, you know, no or an insufficient degree of command and control over what was happening in order for that principle of command responsibility for war crimes to be applicable. It's a complete myth.
I'd forgotten about that myself, actually. You're right, because we had to get permission. I don't want to get arrested for revealing too much, but in certain and the legal officers obviously were right there front and centre, and we had to get permission from that commander, who was General Campbell or the equivalent, if we wanted to do certain missions. So you're absolutely right that they can't say that they weren't involved. They were involved. And as you said, the key thing is that they're there with their outstretched hands every time there's credit, every time there's medals to be given out. But if the shit hits the fan, they run for cover. And that is the exact opposite of what a good officer is meant to do. And I think that's one of the frustrations at the heart of both yours and my complaints, Stuart, is that so much the Defence Force was inverted upside down to what you're meant to do in a proper defence force, and that people at the top are meant to take responsibility. You're not meant to try to shirk responsibility if you're only partly to blame. That's one of the things that they taught me at Sandhurst. I mean, Australians kind of look down their nose at Sandhurst and think it's all chinless wonders. But the one thing that these so-called chinless wonders knew to do is that they knew that their one role was to stand up and be counted if things went wrong. And I think General Campbell would get so much more respect if he said, yeah, look, I need to take some responsibility myself. I think that's what Hurley should do. I need to take some responsibility myself. You know, I have ultimate responsibility, therefore I'm ultimately responsible. But you never see that in the Australian Defence Force, and that kind of turns my stomach.
Well, I think the one of the big problems they have now, and it's interesting to watch this unfold over a longer period of time. The problem that they have now that the war in Afghanistan is over, a lot of the material that, and this is one of the ironies here of talking to you on air about it now, a lot of the material that you are being prosecuted for as a whistleblower for having, you know, allegedly unlawfully disclosed to the public via the media is now quite legitimately entering the public domain anyway, and it's unclassified. And that the point I made before about Australian commanders, you know, making decisions about adding tapes to JPL and so on, it was published in a book, a very good book actually. I think I've mentioned this book to you previously by Ben McKelvey. The book's called Find, Fix, Finish. Very, very well worth a read because it takes the long view as to, you know, how the Australian Special Forces reached a point where, you know, these allegations had been made, and the cultural issues, many of the command issues, and these things date right back to, you know, at least as far as the Tampa incident, you know, which was, you know, not long before September 11 in 2001, and the many decisions over a long period of time which, you know, paved the way for what ultimately led to this major controversy. But, you know, again, the point I make is that the problem that, you know, the Hurleys, the Campbells, the Stephen Smiths and these, you know, gentlemen now face, having kept a lid on this, on their involvement in this controversy and their, you know, potential even indictments in, you know, criminal charges in future, is that this material is entering the public domain anyway. And so it's just festered on their watch. They've gone as far as, you know, prosecuting whistleblowers. And so they've only made the situation worse for themselves in the long term, which seems pretty staggering when you think about how things could unfold eventually.
Yeah, I had a pretty funny conversation yesterday. There's something I can't reveal what it is, but I've got some good news to announce later this week. Mm. It's not the charges have been dropped, but it's something good for me. And the person speaking to me was an American, and they were asking about, they kept on saying, well, what exactly is it that the Australian government feels they need to keep secret?
Yeah.
And I was like, look. And they just couldn't quite understand. I said, I think they're just using it as a tactic. As you said, I said, it's all been out there in the Ben Robert Smith case. There'd be a dozen books written, you know, from Chris Masters down that detail everything that I've got to say. It's been detailed again in Ben McKelvey's very, very good book, Find, Fix, Finish, that you talked about. The idea that it's truly secret is just a con. They're just using it. They're playing all the silly games that they possibly can in order not to give me a fair trial. And if you didn't think the ADF, there was something very wrong in the Defence Department before I went to trial, by the time I'm put in jail, you will realise that there is something quite wrong in the state of Denmark.
Well, here's another little insight into how ridiculous this situation is. In fact, you made a witty remark on social media about a month ago. I think it was in the lead up to your most recent court appearance that the Department of Defence had taken issue with some of your evidence because it apparently contained, you know, maps of certain incidents that had occurred in Afghanistan. So I immediately went to the federal court webpage where the evidence and the exhibits are being posted for the Ben Robert Smith defamation case, And there's literally dozens of images, all fully marked up, imagery from the Heron UAV detachment of specific compounds. The Whiskey 108 compound is front and center. And, you know, all of this imagery is completely unredacted, and the only thing that's redacted is the security classification. So you've got date, time stamps, when the images were taken, which military UAV detachment took them, the whole work. It's all out there. It's all on the public domain, and that's what we'll increasingly see, and it just makes a complete mockery out of it.
But that's not secret anymore.
No, it's not secret.
They just put a cross through it and say, that's not secret.
Yeah.
But then, you know, if McBride talks about where the toilets were and
that's right. Out,
that's totally secret. Double secret. Exactly. Secret.
Exactly. But this is the problem they all now have. And another, it's Nicky, you make that point about Sandhurst, or you're talking about a former colleague in the US, and this is something that's probably not particularly well understood in the Australian audience, but these were coalition operations. So people like yourself and myself literally worked on a daily basis with our coalition colleagues, with our US colleagues, with our British colleagues, you know, individuals from, you know, defence forces right across the world. And I mean, our military reputation, largely because of command and leadership issues like this in the Australian Defence Force, we've been a laughing stock for a long time because of many of these things. And it's just interesting that they've really shot themselves in the foot at the very highest levels of our Defence Force leadership and the political leadership. The longer these sorts of issues drag on, and the longer there's no accountability at the top, but the full weight of accountability is directed at more junior levels, the worse the reputational damage will be, not only internationally, but at home here in Australia as well. I mean, I think the public are starting to wake up to this a little bit. One of the, as stupid and incompetent as our military leadership may be, they're pretty cunning and clever in how they've played this game. And as you know, one of the things that they've done in leaking material as the Brereton Inquiry was underway and leaking related material to certain media outlets to portray the entire, you know, component of special forces in Australia as these horrible criminals, is they've sort of portrayed themselves as these champions of justice. We've got, you know, the head of the Defence Force now going after these awful commanding officers and captains and taking their medals off them. Trying to take attention away from the leadership players at his level. But I think that's slowly but surely that's beginning to catch up with them now, and the public are starting to cotton on to it.
Gentlemen, we'll have to go to another quick ad break. This is TNT.
If you hated America and wanted to destroy her, what would you do? Would you not subvert her sovereignty by flooding her with millions of illegal invaders to eat out her substance and weaken her political institutions? And speaking of politics, would you not pervert her elections by removing safeguards against cheating and then exploit the weaknesses in the system that you created to the point where no one, left or right, has faith that the results are legit? Would you not destroy her ability to feed, clothe, and maintain herself and make her dependent on her enemies for her needs by gutting her manufacturing base, impoverishing her workers, and selling off her farmland? Would you not try to render her helpless by preventing her from defending herself against those who mean her harm? Would you not surrender her energy independence and print so much monopoly money that she risks no longer being the world's reserve currency? Would you not destroy her economy by forcing thousands of small businesses out of business with lockdowns, lawsuits, and legal red tape? If you hated America and wanted to destroy her, what would you do differently than what Democrats have done the past 50 years? From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Hi, Australia. There's never been a better time to check up on your health. We have a world-class healthcare system that's easy to access, even when you can't be there in person. Telehealth enables you to catch up with your GP or health professional, and the Australian government has now made it permanently available through Medicare. Show your health some love, face-to-face, by phone or video call. Care for your health. Find out more at australia.gov.au. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
This is McBride and Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to McBride and Brennan, David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan, and our very special guest, Major Stuart McCarthy. Now, I was getting carried away when you were talking there. I've thought of a couple of examples like that where you're right. I have to, and the Americans are good at this too. You know, while they do so many things wrong on the battlefield, one thing that I have to have grudging respect for in some sort of a professional way is the way they can manipulate the media. I saw something yesterday which was pretty reprehensible. You might have seen it too. I don't mind bringing it up because this was clearly a plant of the Australian Defence Force Public Relations Department, and it shows you how they shoot themselves in the foot in order to make the generals look good. Because of the kerfuffle this week, because General Campbell obviously got a bit of pushback and they weren't happy about it, they published a story yesterday, which wasn't new, but about someone, they named him as SAS, getting stabbed in a brothel in Iraq, and then going to Germany, and then quite a gratuitous story that they didn't have to publish, and then it said, and linked straight into, that's not the only time, and there was an SAS person who pulled a weapon on a person from another agency, and they brought up all of that. And again, it was just to sort of besmirch the SAS, to sort of put out there into the public, these are bad dudes and there's a lot of alcohol and bad sort of bad behavior. When of course the reality is these guys did mission after mission after mission, put their life on the line. And the idea that you would just bring up a couple of incidents, which you know, there's a lot of unknowns about them anyway, just to besmirch them in order to protect Campbell this week is pretty reprehensible. But that's what they were like. There was no idea of the big picture, no idea of, hang on, are we going to go backwards by rubbishing our own defence forces in order to protect the generals, in order to protect the ministers, because, you know, the latest bump in the polling says that they're not popular. Therefore, let's put out a story that rubbishes the SAS. It's pretty reprehensible, but yeah, they control the media, and a lot of the stories are there to nudge people into thinking something in particular.
Well, I mean, I saw that. I shouldn't laugh because it's actually very serious. It's a cynical laugh. I saw that story pop up this morning, and it's like clockwork. You know, as soon as there's any questions raised at that leadership level or allegations. I mean, the piece I wrote this morning was, you know, really questioning whether General Campbell should even be leading the Defence Force. But, you know, like clockwork, we see this another, you know, shock horror, big controversial story. I mean, I didn't even bother reading it. I read the headline and thought, here we go. About some soldier stabbed in a brothel in the Middle East. Now, and it's worth I know listeners here would probably be interested to dig into how this game works in a little bit more detail. You know, the really good specialist journalists, and in our case we're talking about defense reporters and so on. If they're leaked a story like this, I mean, they will ask around, they'll try to verify, they'll talk to as many people as they can to either, you know, verify, prove, disprove the story, or at least provide some sort of expert comment on it to put it in the overall context. But it looks like this was another story that was leaked. I mean, I suspect it probably came from the minister's office. And the reason I say that is that the journalist it was leaked to is a political reporter, you know, and we're talking about press gallery in Canberra. That might not be the case. It might have come out of the Department of Defence. But with stories like this, what tends to happen is because they're impossible to disprove, because a political reporter, someone is press gallery who, and they tend to be a bit of a captive audience anyway. They get this big juicy leak, comes from the minister's office. It's about, you know, something that happened overseas involving, you know, special forces troops. So it becomes, in their mind, it becomes incontestable because either the Department of Defence or the minister's office are these, you know, in their minds, they're this authority figure. And so they tend to publish these stories unverified, no context, no expert comment, and they just get a run. And you can see the Defence Department, a succession of ministers for defence, have just played these press gallery journalists time and time and time again to take the heat, take the heat off themselves. I mean, you and I both know, David, this might sound a little too cynical, and before I make this comment, I'll say that, look, we are fortunate enough, we still do have some very good senior officers, some very good generals in the Defence Force. But in the main, their principal motivation is self-preservation. You know, their first thought when they get up in the morning, their last thought, you know, before they go to sleep at night is, how do I survive this? How do I survive the next controversy? How do I keep my nose clean? And they will do anything, they will say anything, even to the point of, you know, criminality in my mind, to just keep themselves, you know, impune from any of the, you know, from accountability for any of their own wrongdoing. And but as I said before, you know, I think the public and the media are starting to cotton on to this a little bit more as the war wound up last year, and more of this material is starting to quite legitimately enter the.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. It gave me a lot of pleasure after the Brereton report was released, and he famously said, nobody above the rank of corporal could be criticised in any way. I met members of the public who don't even know that much about it, didn't follow it closely, and they'd say to me without any prompting, they'd say, that must be bullshit. How could no one know anything and no one be blamed? You know, everybody knows if you're the class captain in kindergarten and you've got some naughty boy playing up, you know, you get a kick in the butt as well. Everybody knows that that's just the principle. The idea that they could be whitewashed and blame the people down below and the people with all the sort of or the scrambled egg on their shoulders, the people who were the first to go to the Gallipoli 100-year and all there in the front row and taking all the glory and thinking that they're so clever and they've got all the medals, none of them could be blamed. I mean, the public know that that's not right.
Well, I had an interesting conversation. This was with a family member of one of the deceased Australian soldiers who was in fact killed during one of the green on blue incidents. And this might give you a cynical chuckle as well. He said to me, and because we were talking about the Brereton allegations and some of the individuals who were involved in these allegations and which missions they'd gone on, and this was around the time Ben McKelvey's most recent book was published, and this gentleman said to me, it was a very, very astute remark, actually. He said, Stuart, you know, it's not like, you know, these corporals got on a Black Hawk helicopter like as a taxi and decided to just go out there and kill people. But this is the sort of context that is so often removed from the media coverage. You just can't – the way that the military works generally and the way that these operations were conducted, it's not – I mean, you know – for the record, yes, there's certainly a number of these individuals definitely have a case to answer. There's no question about that. And there is a process underway. The Office of the Special Investigator has been established, and presumably at some point criminal charges will be laid against some of these junior ranking soldiers. But even if and when some of those prosecutions succeed and individuals are found guilty of various serious crimes of murder, it's not like they went to these places of their own volition. They didn't jump in a 737 with their own M4, head over to Afghanistan, decide to stay there on 4 monthly rotations, and go and call up a Black Hawk helicopter like it was an Uber and head out and go and kill people. These things all happened on missions that were approved at certain levels up the chain of command, and it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, look at the top down. I mean, General Hurley's got a case to answer, and he's got to satisfy the public that he didn't know anything, and then if he didn't know anything, we go to the person underneath him. But the idea was,
or the person above him,
or the person above him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who's now going to reform the Defence Force? What a great choice.
Well, we have to remember too, when General Campbell was the commander of JTF 633, he had, let me think, 1, 2, 3 individuals above him in the military chain of command and then a minister, okay? So there's a chain of accountability there too.
I totally agree, and I think that nothing would restore the faith for the Australian people that we start looking at the top down rather than the bottom up. I mean, the Australians know, as you said, there's a case to answer, but the guys down in the mud, down in the blood, it can't just be them that we put in the dock. We've got to look at the top. That's the whole point of getting paid a general's wage. That's the whole point. Of wearing the sword on your shoulder, is that you take the blame, or you take the responsibility when things go wrong. And I think the public need to see that. And you're right, the Australian Defence Force, they think they're so clever because they've become a bit like politicians. All they care about is sort of popularity back home, but they don't realise that they're a laughing stock around the other military.
They are a laughing stock. And that's been the case for a long time, a very, very long time.
And that matters. If we have to fight a war against China, which they keep talking up, you're not going to go very well if everybody thinks the leaders are absolute buffoons.
No.
That really matters. We need to have a leadership, and they'd get so much more respect, not only from Australia but from the soldiers, if they took a little bit of blame. So I could have done better.
Yeah.
That's why Hastie went up in my estimation. I love the fact that Hastie was able to say, I could have done better.
Yeah.
I have to wear some of this responsibility. Yeah. He's from the Liberal Party, and we don't agree on a lot of things, but I think that was great, the way he said, look, I take responsibility for some things that went wrong. I mean, that's all you need. We're not going to flog a dead horse, but you just need someone to be able to say that, and then they've got credibility. But I think, we select the worst people to become CDF. There are some good generals, absolutely good generals, but the ones that get to the top seem to be selected because they are yes men, because they will never do anything except ingratiate themselves with the minister.
Well, if you want to end up like on a board of directors of Raytheon or a Lockheed Martin or some private intelligence firm, it's good to stay out of trouble. It's good for the CV.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Maybe we're the dumb ones.
Yeah.
But it's so good to speak to you, and we agree, we've been together for a while, and to have other people contact us, you know, send you, see us both on Twitter, contact us.
Well,
and
it was interesting.
We're only ever seeking change.
One interesting thing I saw this week was we had the head of the SAS Association, the head of the Commando Association, and blow me down with a feather, the head of the RSL issued a joint statement to the media, making many of the same criticisms that people like yourself and myself have been making for some time.
Yes, well, hopefully we'll get some sort of action. And but it's been fantastic to have you on. We might have to get you back.
Yeah,
of course.
Love to come back. We have other issues to discuss, apparently.
Absolutely. We only scratched the surface, didn't we?
We did. We did.
And it was good. Thank you, Robert, for letting us two old soldiers drone on together.
No, it was my pleasure as a civilian. I take a bow to both.
Music to my ears.
All right. This is TNT. Catch you later.